Welcome to the Being Human podcast, brought to you by Relate Malaysia. Join us in our conversations about what makes us human and why we think and behave in the ways that we do. We'll talk about mental health, emotional well-being, and how we can sometimes feel on top of the world, and other times like life calls for a large tub of ice cream and a big spoon. So come on in, relax, and let's explore this puzzle of being human together.
Hello and welcome to the Being Human podcast. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and today I'm joined by Dr. Christopher Muran, who is the Associate Dean and Professor at the Gordon F. Derner School of Psychology at Delphi University, where he previously served as the Training Director for the Doctoral Program in Clinical Psychology. Chris has published over 160 papers and 10 books, including Therapist Performance Under Pressure, Negotiating Emotion, Difference and Rupture with Catherine Eubanks, and the Therapeutic Alliance and Evidence-Based Guide to Practice with Jacques Barber. In this episode, we'll be discussing what it means to have a therapeutic alliance between therapists and their clients and what happens when that alliance is either lacking or ruptured. And Chris will also be sharing his thoughts about how clients can get a sense of whether a therapist is the right fit for them as they go through the first session. So welcome to the show, Chris. How are you?
Good. Thank you. And thank you for the invitation. I'm looking forward to questions to mull over.
Yes. So I'm delighted to have you here. And we discovered already that both of us study in Canada. So the common, hopefully that means we're going to have nice conversations here.
Hopefully better than the way Montreal and Toronto immerse.
That's right. So my first question, it's sort of, you know, we talk a lot maybe about the therapeutic alliance, and I don't even think therapists really know what it means. You know, we kind of toss that out and saying that's important. All we know that that's important, and then we tell the client that's important, but I think few of us actually know what that is. Right. So maybe you can shed some light on that.
Sure. I mean, it's a concept that has taken on many different definitions and functions over generations. And so it was born as a psychoanalytic construct to begin with. And, you know, in psychoanalysis, there are multiple schools of thought, but in the ego-psychological tradition, it was important theoretically and politically to develop this notion to deal with the real relationship and like how therapists deal with real aspects of the work that they're doing together. You know, there are other psychoanalytic models like the interpersonal tradition that didn't feel a need for such a concept. And so you didn't see much talk about it there. Yeah. So I won't go into all the different definitions. I'm just going to really settle on one that's actually most widely recognized these days, which was introduced by Ed Borden in the 1970s. And Borden reformulated the alliance to make it more appealing and understandable to different traditions. So according to Borden, he talked about the alliance as comprised of three components, but I'm going to organize it around two dimensions, which the research seems to support. And one is this notion of purposeful collaboration, to what extent patient therapists are working together and working on, you know, have some basic agreement of how to work and what to work on. And so this collaborative dimension is a huge dimension. And then the other important dimension is called the affective bond. And it refers to what extent patient therapists have mutual trust and respect for each other, and to what extent they prize each other. So it's a more affective dimension of that relationship. And they really work hand in hand. You can't have one with necessarily the other in most cases. I mean, the other way to think about the alliance, and this is where, you know, the contributions of Carl Rogers are very important, is you think about also what's missing in a relationship. And so if there's an experience of by the patient of holding back or hiding negative feelings, you know, any form of discontent, that's not necessarily a good thing. If you have a feeling of being misunderstood, feeling of being overly judged, or even a sense at times of giving up. Those can be considered markers of problems in the alliance. And to have those experiences occasionally is fine and should be expected. But if you have it a lot, if it's sustained or chronic, then those should be markers of concern in terms of the alliance. But circling back, you do want to have a sense that you're working together and there's this kind of trust and respect going back and forth.
Yeah. So if I was, you know, just regular non-therapist person, I would say, like, why is it then such a complicated word, like a therapeutic alliance? Why don't you just call it, you know, like relating or like being close, you know?
Well, look, you know, in the interpersonal tradition, as I alluded to earlier, they had no use for the alliance because they were, it's about the therapeutic relationship. Mm-hmm. And in the humanistic tradition, and I'm talking about these traditions in gross terms, but, you know, the Rogerian thread, they had no use for the alliance. So they were talking about, you know, relatedness, you know, and, right. And the therapeutic relationship or the bond. I mean, there's so many terms that have been used interchangeably. Right. And even one of the most seminal psychoanalytic contributions to the alliance was by Ralph Greenson in the 1960s. And he said you can think of the therapeutic relationship in terms of three dimensions: the transference dimension, the working alliance, and the real relationship. But he said conceptually these are kind of important, but in practical terms they're so intertwined that they're not as discrete as one would like to see them as that. And it's a useful contribution, but people to this day still look at the tripartite model and they kind of still think about them as discrete, and they're not that discrete. But I think your question's great because there are a lot of people who, and we even wrote an article, like when I say we, my late colleague Jeremy Safran wrote an article about whether the alliance construct is really useful or not. So we were even subversive about our own work and the idea that it's, you know, I don't know how useful the term is, or relationalists where, you know, we believe in intersubjectivity, we're interpersonalists. I mean, yeah, I don't know. So the alliance is.
Yeah. And I guess it's kind of that there's a strong, you know, this is theoretical foundation to the term, but then in practice and in the experience is just, are we connecting? I guess the client isn't thinking so much in so many terms.
Absolutely. Right. And an important measure of connecting is, are we collaborating? Are we working together, you know, right, in a productive like way that, you know, because there's going to be conflict. And when I know at some point we'll talk about ruptures, but there's going to be conflict. There's always going to be conflict because you have two individuals with different needs and desires, you know, clashing. And
wait, therapists have needs and desires? What? We are just 100% accepting and we have no needs. Chris, what are you talking about?
Right. I mean, there's this, you know, in the field, there's been a longstanding effort to like neutralize the therapist factor. You know, in psychoanalysis, there was, you got to get personal analysis so that you can have all your countertransference impulses understood and removed so you can be this like perfect blank screen for your patient's projections. A more recent iteration of that is manualized treatment. If we manualize all these treatments, we can remove the therapist's individual difference factor. And yet all the data, you know, speaks to how predictive therapist individual differences are. So like the alliance is predictive, but equally predictive, maybe more predictive are the differences between therapists. And some therapists are better at alliances and better at outcomes than others. And, right. And our work is very much predicated on therapists' individual differences, how they manage their own needs. And yeah, the therapist needs to be effective, and the therapist needs to do to comply with whatever orientation they've pledged allegiance to. You know, there are all these, you know, professional needs, and then there are personal needs, you know, in terms of like therapists have their own relationship to achievement, self-definition, and relatedness and communion, those like fundamental needs that people have written a lot about. So, and those needs are dialectical. They don't necessarily work in concert. There's always going to be some tension between those two needs. So like the patient who struggles with those needs, the therapist is also in pursuit of fulfilling those needs or motivations. They're difficult within the individual, and they're difficult to negotiate between individuals. And of course, it's going to play out in a therapy relationship.
Yeah. So one way, and you know, let me know what you think about this, is that how I've thought about the therapeutic alliance and taught it to my students is that the therapeutic alliance is where you're going, like what road you're taking, and who you're going with. And if you like those, you know, if you like who you're going with and you trust that person, and so that's the relational bit. And, you know, there's a clear going and the path is clear, you know, like how you're going to get there. And that's the collaborative bit. Yeah.
That's the task and goal bit. Like, to what extent are we like on the right path and driving the right car?
Right. And so I guess, you know, in that image, I could see how the personality of the individual needs of the therapist come into play, right? Because you're actually two people on this journey. And, you know, one person might like to stop and smell the flowers more than the other, you know, and you point out about manualized therapy, is that there is this huge pressure to get everything done in 12 sessions, right? Because 12 sessions is the magical number.
Right.
And I mean, for our listeners, I will say that, you know, most of the evidence-based therapies are usually tested to say, like, are they effective within 12 sessions? You know, there's other than that, there's not something more magical about 12 sessions, but there's just the average and that's the norm that people use to in these clinical trials. So that's why we use 12 sessions as a...
Actually, I'm not sure about the evidence base for that. That may be pretty arbitrary.
Oh, no, it is arbitrary. Yeah. Yeah.
The evidence that comes to mind to me is old. It's an old effort by, you know, Ken Howard, where he looked at the dosage effect. And, you know, of course, all these things are based on the quality of the measures, and there's so many variables at play. But what he demonstrated was that things tend to plateau around session 25, 26. So if you're looking for evidence for what would be the more reasonable treatment length, you'd be thinking more 25, 26. But that's not, you know, I mean, they're all these different personalities and considerations. Some patients bring more issues.
So just in case anyone's worried, like, exactly what Chris says, you know, 12 is short, but, you know, it does, again, you know, put pressure on the therapists, especially new therapists. So we've got a lot to juggle. And so how do we even, I guess, is there some way that we could lay a foundation to build an effective relationship with our clients? You know, how do we do that? When do we do that? At my first session, do you need to feel like you're my best friend? You go home and you think, oh my gosh, that was the best, you know, meeting ever. Is that a sign of an effective, you know, alliance?
Well, the first thing I would say, which has always been like a pet peeve of mine, I mean, there's this longstanding notion like, oh, you first build rapport and then you do the treatment, which is really crazy. You really are doing everything at once. And I don't even know what just like, I mean, you may really need to build rapport by doing something. You don't just build rapport. But to be more specific to your question, I talked about collaboration. You have a wonderful metaphor about that. How do you build collaboration? Okay. I mean, in that regard, I think you can be really deliberate about it. You can share the decision-making process. You can always be checking in with them, getting their perspective, invite feedback. So be very deliberate about the collaborative component. Ask them if they want to drive the car.
Things like that. You see, you know? It's a great metaphor, right? Like you're using it already.
Exactly. So, and then of course, you know, they're important. Like Rogers talked about these basic facilitating conditions. It's still true. Like empathy, try to really understand the other person's experience. Take time to understand it. It's okay if you're wrong. The point is you're trying to understand, and you can be wrong until you're right. Be appreciative of the other person and their uniqueness. You know, it's not, you may not like some of their behaviors, but there's still this unique other that should be prized in some sense, to like, you know, the effort to try to understand another communicates that. And then my favorite is really being genuine, being authentic, don't be pretentious. Be kind of true to yourself at the same time. You know, we have all these manualized treatments, but I think that you still have to incorporate the treatment principles into who you are, you know, as a person. So there is some balancing of executing, and I'm using the word principles because I think it's important to think about principles at a more abstract level than specific interventions. But, you know, what are you trying to do? Are you trying to expand their awareness? Are you trying to create new experiences for them? You know, and then you can reduce that to specific interventions. But think in terms of principles and try to find a way that's kind of congruent with who you are. I always remember I had the experience of actually being supervised by Albert Ellis when I was a graduate student.
Wow. And
personality wise, we were similar because we're both shy people, but he was much more of a like charismatic, irreverent character. And that wasn't what I was going to ever be. But the thing I always appreciated about him, and I still have some of his evaluations of me, and he says, does it his own way. He basically gave me permission to do it my way, not do it the Albert Ellis RET way kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, I think there's something really to that. People, there are a lot of, and also I should say, it's no surprise, you actually see certain personalities gravitate to certain treatment models mm-hmm. versus others. And I think that's a interesting way to sort of, you know, see how people try to like be true to themselves. But I do worry about people pretending or being inauthentic. Right. And then the last thing I'd say in terms of the question is pay attention to your own experience. In addition, you're trying to understand the patient's experience, but paying attention to your own experience, your own emotional reactions can be a compass to what's going on. There's so much research about how emotions co-regulate, you know, how experience of one affects the other and back and forth. So to ignore what you're feeling is like putting a blindfold to yourself in terms of what's going on in the process. And of course, related to that, pay attention to the interpersonal field, the dance that the two of you may be engaged in, you know, like, are you working together? Are you bouncing off of each other? How good is the dance? Are you stepping on each other's feet too much? Watch the field, watch your experience, in addition to trying to understand your patient's experience.
Right. That's so there's a lot going on, you know, like for a therapist to think about, because you said a lot of things that kind of just got my mind thinking. And I think one thing is how overwhelming it can be for a new therapist to think about all these things. And that's often the feedback I get. And so the second thing is, do you think that nice people, you know, if maybe if we just like our clients enough, we won't have these ruptures. You know, if I'm nice enough and I'm like super loving and super caring, maybe I will never rupture and with the lion. So like, okay, I'm going to use this term that I'm actually then going to toss to you to define. like, what is a rupture? You know, but because that's one thing I often hear is I get so many trainees who are just trying to be nice. And they think, if I'm just nice enough, then nothing bad will ever happen, or that ruptures only happen with clients that are difficult. You know, we have all these sort of assumptions.
I think being nice is a good thing. So I don't want to...
Says the disciple of Albert Ellis.
That's right. I think that can help you a lot. I do think the idea of avoiding rupture is misbegotten, though. And now, it is a favorite, though, of all therapists, young and old, to try to avoid rupture. But there is an inevitability that you have to wrap your mind around. Okay. You are talking about two individuals with very unique personality configurations. Every individual, if you think about it, has had very different experiences in their lives. And that can be, you know, so there's no such thing. It's like, I guess the notion of snowflakes being all unique, there's no such thing. You can't have these perfect matches. And sometimes you can delude yourself thinking like, oh, we're very similar, or it can blind you to the differences too. But you have to really fundamentally appreciate that everyone's different. And so invariably that's going to bring in clashes. Now, let me give some research to support this. So first of all, in terms of our own research, whether you're looking at self-report or observer-based, self-report, you know, patient therapists are reporting ruptures in like 20 to 50% of their sessions. That's a lot. That's self-report. That's not the stuff that they're unaware of, right? In our observer-based measure, the numbers are much higher. But let me cite another, I think, very useful bit of research, which comes from the mother-infant research world and from the work of Ed Tronick. And Ed Tronick, it likes to invoke our work and sort of talk about how, you know, how common ruptures are. He uses the term, you know, misattunement, misalignment. And in his study of mother-infant interactions, he found that the prevalence of misattunement was around 70%, you know, in interactions, and that it's not about misattunement, it's about reattunement or repair. And it's in the repair that a child can learn really important developmental lessons about being able to reconnect with others. Learning to reconnect is huge in the sense of like building a sense of efficacy and hope. He has another study where he actually looked at differences between healthy mother-infant diets and unhealthy ones. And what he found in the healthy ones, there would be misattunement, reattunement, misattunement, reattunement. In the unhealthy ones, he found misattunement, 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 misattunement. So it's not about, I'm citing these things because it's not like, oh, you should be avoiding ruptures. No, your attention really should be at the repair. Right. You should be trying to mine the ruptures, looking for them, because they can be windows into the other, into understanding the uniqueness of the other. So it moves you from objectifying the other, which we invariably do, and this has social cultural implications. This is an old existential notion. In any human relationship, any interpersonal encounter, our first move is to objectify, put people into categories based on our own experiences or social constructions. This is prejudice. This is the basis, but this is the basis of human relations. And then it's in the struggle with the other that, you know, in the, you know, the rejection of the objectification, the battle that ensues, that you begin to sort of see the uniqueness of the other subjectivity. And that helps inform your own subjectivity. It's an old existential notion. It's been modernized in contemporary analytic terms, feminist terms. It was developed, a lot of it gets tied back to the philosopher Hegel, but Simone de Beauvoir developed it further. She get more credit than Jean-Paul Sartre. She does. but then it got brought into contemporary relational terms by Jessica Benjamin, who's been really influential in this regard. But she really normalized this idea that there are these power plays that go on between individuals. And certainly in the therapeutic relationship, we put people in the categories just like anybody else. And we also have diagnostic categories to offend people, to put people in diagnostic boxes. And, if you think about any of your relationships and you think about any of your therapeutic relationships, yeah, in time you get to know the person and it becomes harder to fit them into those original boxes. They're just not a borderline, or they're just not a this. They're right. Much more complicated than that. Right. And that's means you've kind of moved from objectifying to subjectifying.
Right. So
that's a long-winded answer.
No, it was a great answer. And I'm going to do the therapist thing. Just let me just see if I got that right. But I think one thing that struck me was that we have to accept we can't prevent these ruptures. That they will happen, and they're not bad in itself, right? It can actually be an opportunity to get closer to someone in a very unique way. Of I like the work that you were citing just before of the existential, and it's also quite psychodynamic. Even the Eden Project, James Holland, shout out on that. That's a great book of that. We have this idealized version of who the therapist is. And the therapist has this notion in their head of, maybe informed by diagnostic categories of who the client is. And and getting closer means we have to kind of challenge our preconceived notions that we already automatically form. As soon as we maybe we read some information about the person, or we Googled our therapist before we went to the session, we have some ideas of who this person is. And I tell my clients, I said, inevitably I'll disappoint you. I'll say something that isn't great and isn't understanding, and it's kind of just not super empathic, don't need to wait for that to happen. I'm telling you will happen, and do let me know when it happens. But as you said, I find that clients aren't going to be the ones who clients rarely tell you it happens. They rarely confront. You're talking about the repairing of the ruptures. So is it on the therapist to kind of catch those moments, and how do we do that?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, but before I answer that, I also want to say that putting people in the categories, and for us that includes these diagnostic categories or case formulations that are been structured in terms of whatever orientation we pledge allegiance to, they're not inherently bad. They're there, to help organize ambiguity. So a lot of the things that we do, it's all about helping us negotiate ambiguity, not understanding what's going on. So these, so a lot of it's about helping therapists regulate their own anxiety of not knowing. So again, that's not a bad thing. But we have to understand what they're there for, and then subsequently what they can give, but also not give, and maybe blind us to differences. So they're tools, but they're not perfectly precise. And the task of the work is really to elaborate and to get into the details more. So I wanted to say that to start. And then your question was about
what are we going to do? So we've got the ruptures.
Right.
But first of all, we didn't define ruptures, but
I will get to that.
Oh, you get to the definition of rupture.
I'll do that.
I was just going to say rupture means like, is it like, it's like it could be an argument, a conflict. Would that be?
There's
so many types.
It is unfortunate, the term. And like a lot of these terms, including the alliance, they kind of exist for political reasons as much as anything else. So at a point, we became known for our work on rupture. And, you know, that was the car we bought and drove. And we were the rupture people. So that bought us something, but it also... it confused too, because rupture is a dramatic term, right. And so,
well, it's so scary, right? To think, alliance ruptured,
like a hernia or something, appendix ruptures. But you know, for us, ruptures. There's an explicit level of what we mean by that, which is lack of collaboration, trust, and respect, right? But at an implicit level, we mean there's a breakdown in the negotiation of the needs and identities of both patient and therapist. And I talked about the need for self-definition and relatedness. I talked a little bit about objectification, subjectification. So these are like fundamental related dialectics that are at the heart of rupture. But to be even more specific and helpful in understanding it, we've made the distinction between two categories of rupture markers. Withdrawal ruptures, which are movements away or movements towards isolation. And these can include like silences, minimal responses. This also could be, again, these are markers. They can be patient behavior or they can be therapist behavior. Sometimes therapists go silent and it's a marker of confusion or mind, you're wandering, thinking about something else. There are markers of denial, content affect split, where someone is smiling but talking about something that's really sad. So an effort to mask what's really going on. There are topic shifts, storytelling, abstract talk. And again, therapists can engage in this. Therapists engage in psychobabble sometimes, you know. And then there's these, you know, movements towards the other, appeasing movements to be overly protective or overly accommodating, and both patient therapists can do this. So these are withdrawal markers, movements away, movements towards, and so this is usually surprising to people because it surprises them to think of these as ruptures. The other category, which is not so surprising, is confrontation ruptures, and these are movements against the other. These are movements towards criticism or control, criticizing the other. Patients can criticize their therapist for, you know, not being competent or not dressing like a professional or something, or even engage in microaggressions. Therapists can be critical of patients. They can pathologize patients. They can put them, you know, invoke their own theories to insult and belittle patients. There are complaints about treatment tasks and progress. The therapist can do that too and blame the patient, you know, for lack of, you know, complying. There are defensive moves, pushing back on the other. There are coercions like being overly friendly or overly seductive. So these are the kinds of markers that we would consider confrontation markers. And by the way, you'll also see a lot of mixed, you know, markers. Patients will confront and then withdraw, you know, like they'll pull their punches. The other thing I'll say to tie it back to the dialectics, withdrawal markers can be understood as pursuits of connection at the expense of self-definition, that you basically hide a real aspect of yourself, or you shut down a real aspect of yourself in order to maintain your attachment with the therapist. And then confrontation is the reverse. It's the I'm pursuing self-definition at the expense of relatedness. So they represent trouble in negotiating that dialectic.
So there's the withdrawal, and then there's a confrontation, and you're saying the withdrawal, and it's really about the dynamic between wanting to connect with the person or wanting to, you know, you called it self-definition. Is it just wanting to be myself, like be authentic? Could I use that?
Feeling agentic, which means like I'm doing something, I feel effective, you know, right. Experience of efficacy. And then you can, I think we talked about this maybe before we went on air, but it can be really tied, because you may being effective mm-hmm. also leads to wanting to be recognized for that. Mm-hmm. And that can be a way in which you connect with others, you know, it's celebrated by others, you know.
But that makes sense. So, I guess we could kind of see the therapeutic alliance or the sort of the connection between the therapist and the client really as having these two aspects. Do you feel connected to this person, and do you feel like yourself, right? That could be another way of saying that.
And,
exactly. Right. That's and good. when you know, you don't feel connected or you don't feel like yourself, then the relationship isn't going well.
Yeah.
And that, you know, the research has shown that that's going to affect your progress as well, or how you're going to do in therapy, how useful therapy could be for you. And then we're going to throw you this challenge of how do we actually then repair ruptures? You know, we can do it. We can do 2 minutes, and I can be a client and you can see how fast. I mean, which is just kind of, I think, just show maybe how you deal with it rather than avoid it. I think that's sort of the key thing. And I will say that we can't actually finish. We won't actually cover the, you know, you're not actually going to reconcile everything, but is there a way to maybe, how did you maybe even direct a client who just gives you one word answers or is upset at you?
So the critical principles for me, and then I can be more concrete about it. Is that, you know, you're always trying to hunt for them. That doesn't mean rupture markers. That doesn't mean you talk about every freaking rupture, okay? Because there's going to be a ton of them. If you become exquisitely attuned to ruptures and how we define ruptures, you're going to see them everywhere. It's like,
right? Because you said 70, almost like what, 25 to 50% self-report, right?
It's like that movie. What was it, Sixth Sense?
I see ghosts everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So you'll see ruptures everywhere. But and to try to talk about every rupture, it's like, I remember back in the 70s, they had this, you know, assertion training was really popular. Actually, it's part of DBT. But one important principle about assertion is you don't assert all the time, because then you'll become annoying.
Yes, right.
So with ruptures, it's the same thing. And I wish I could say more about when to pursue versus not, but and this is where it gets tricky, because you can talk yourself out of doing things. But as we talked about earlier, there can be cultural factors that make you not want to confront. Mm-hmm. But you also have to be really careful not to avoid and let something fester. So if I were to recognize a rupture, if like you were upset or if you went quiet.
If all of a sudden I stop talking and I just don't want to answer.
Yeah, I could do many different things. I might want to wait a little bit, you know, in an immediate sense to see, because I do, privacy is important. Allowing people to reflect is important. But then I might say like, I'm wondering what's going on for you. Something very simple like that. Like you're going quiet. I notice you're going quiet. Would you be willing to share a little bit? You know, I'm always checking in. I'm always asking permission, because I think like tentative, supportive facilitation is really important. I could also see myself saying, you know, self-disclosing, say, you know, in a certain situation, I might say, I'm feeling kind of shut out right now. Mm-hmm. or I'm feeling kind of disconnected or lost. And you know, there's an important principle. We list all these like principles that you should consider, but like you're trying to continue to court collaboration. So even around a rupture, which is a marker of lack of collaboration, you're trying to invite collaboration about rupture repair. And that has to begin with like, we got a problem. Can we can we agree that we got an issue, that something's happening between us? And I think another important principle is therapists have to be, and this is an attitudinal thing, but it really shapes how you, whatever you say, whether you try to explore the other person's experience or say, you know, another form would be like, I feel like we're together stuck right now. Or then the other one version I gave you was talking about my own experience.
Right. Is
try to cultivate the sense, you know, like you probably are responsible in some way. There is some responsibility on your part for this situation. And if you fully embrace that, it colors the way you talk, you know, it colors the way you ask your questions. You want to create the sense of we-ness, that the rupture was co-created and the resolution has to be co-created.
I noticed that you didn't say, you know, you didn't make it sort of personal to say, are you offended by something I said? You know, it's kind of sort of straight away. It's not a terrible response, but you know,
That's a good one too. I mean, you could try that. Was there something I said that offended you?
Mm-hmm.
If that seemed right, if you had this inkling, like, ooh, you know, like
maybe you said right.
This gets back to the idea, like, listen to yourself. Like, if you feel, you know, you might have the feeling like I crossed a line here. I might have said something offensive, or hurtful, or you know. I mean, the vignette I would have played would talked about, I talked about, I disappointed you in some way. Can you say more about that? You know, like you're inviting discontent and negativity, supporting negativity. Now that might not be comfortable to therapists, but this is where you asked me before, who's responsible for the rupture? I mean, I'm pretty mutual in a lot of respects, but I do feel like there's kind of a professional requirement that we need to step up and be maybe more responsible for trying to identify it. But it is, I can also tell you stories where patients have like brought the rupture to my attention where I have noticed it. You know, like, and they've been, you know, there's some great stories of patients carrying the burden of recognizing and repairing. Not entirely. I mean, you still need collaboration on it. But the therapist may be more oblivious. And like you mentioned before about patients keeping things quiet and being reluctant to be negative. Yeah, there's a lot of research, qualitative research supporting that. There's also a lot of research demonstrating how oblivious therapists can be to, you know, negative process. And
the example that we went through before was when the client was withdrawing. And I was wondering what happens if the therapist withdraws. What does the therapist do?
Again, I would probably encourage therapists to talk about that experience. You know,
Not like if you as a therapist are experiencing a rupture, put it in a box, put it on a shelf, go away, and then don't talk about it.
Or go seek out your supervisor to work it out. Because I do think in the end, look, like I said, ruptures are co-created, they're co-resolved. The only way to resolve a rupture is with the other. You know, you need to engage, you know, it's a bit of a subversive position because it doesn't put everything on the therapist, you know. Mm-hmm. The therapist needs the patient to figure out what's going on, and the figuring out of what's going on is the resolution process. And without self-disclosure, I don't think you need self-disclosure all the time for repair, but there are going to be critical times where therapist self-disclosure is going to be the only way to get through something. So being aware of, you know, of whether you felt offended and withdrew because of that, or you found your mind drifting. Like I talked about mind wandering, or like, oh God, I'm aware of like drifting right now and I'm not quite sure what's going on, and inviting the other to help, you know, and I mean, it's because the other is like droning on about something, but that might be really important, you know, like an important interaction. And the therapist might not know, and this is important, again, because it's, this is where it's subversive. I'm like, I'm attacking the authority of the therapist. The self-disclosure, you may not know where it's going to lead. You can't really know, because you still need the other to help you sort it all out. You only know a piece of it. It's like the famous, you know, metaphor of the three blind men and the elephant. You're just describing an aspect of the elephant. You need the other to describe maybe another aspect, and then you get a better sense of what. So the truth emerges in the dialogue, from the dialogue. And so the therapist doesn't sit there as the ultimate arbiter of what happened and you know, what should happen.
I mean, that really emphasizes sort of the equality, you know, between the therapist and the client. I mean, we often talk about power dynamics, but, yeah. You know, in the way as talking about it, that, you know, to bond well, you know, to have a really sort of an honest relationship, both have to be of equal power.
I think to bring it back to the alliance construct is where we started. The early definitions of the alliance were a bit one-sided. It was a little bit about to what extent the patient identifies with the therapist's agenda, you know, of how things should go. Borden's definition put much more of emphasis on mutuality, which is why we really appreciated it and embraced it. And then we elaborated by bringing in, you know, Borden's for us explained the explicit level, but at the implicit level, we said, there are all these needs and identities that are being negotiated. There's this intersubjective negotiation going on that contemporary relational analysts like Jessica Benjamin and Phil Bromberg and Stuart Peiser talk about.
So I don't want to sound dumb, but that was a rupture. What's an intersubjective?
So intersubjective negotiation. So intersubjectivity, we're talking about how two subjectivities are in relationship and how the needs of one are being negotiated with the needs of the other. You see? So that was an elaboration that my colleague Jeremy Saffer and I and now Catherine Eubanks really have like contributed to the alliance construct. But as you said, did we need the alliance construct? I mean, you know,
am I inviting you to this podcast only to destroy your work? No.
You know, and some of it's political, because the alliance construct has become a big thing. It's been it's a variable that's been researched up the wazoo, right? Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of data supporting it. So we're part of that. But we like to think of our work as kind of second generation, because it kind of elaborates and then gets at, it's not just like, oh, the alliance is important. And like, as you suggested earlier, what does that mean? So for us, it's like, we get at the rupture, like, okay, because we don't want to give you just the correlation coefficient demonstrating its importance. We want to say, yeah, and then when this happens, then try this or try that, you know, like actually give data that's user-friendly to the clinician. And correlation coefficients are not user-friendly.
No. So we got to wrap up. So I think for our listeners who aren't therapists, but who might want to see a therapist, one simple thing. So one thing that you might tell them that they could maybe keep an eye out for or you know, kind of think about to just get a sense of whether the therapist is the right fit for them, what would it be?
Because collaboration is so important. Do you feel like you're working together, that the tasks and the goals, like the road you're on and the destination you're headed towards, makes sense to you? Like,
I believe that's the metaphor I gave you, Chris.
Yeah, that's your metaphor.
Yeah, that's my metaphor.
I'm trying to be collaborative. So has the therapist given you a rationale that resonates to you, that makes you feel you're on the right path? Right. The other thing is that, do you trust this? This gets more the affect. Do you trust the therapist? Do you feel heard and appreciated? Right. Do you feel safe and secure enough in their presence? And again, I'm not suggesting perfection. I think rupture is going to be part of the game. You know, do you feel like you can talk about a rupture? Do you feel like you can say something about whether you feel offended or unheard or unappreciated? It's not like, I don't want someone who's pursuing therapy to think like, I got to find a rupture-free zone. That's not mm-hmm. fair.
Yeah. And I think it's a little bit like dating. Like if it's a for sure no, then don't go back. You know, yeah. if you're on the fence and you think, okay, maybe I need another session, then okay, you can try it out. And if for sure yes, then okay, go back. But you got to kind of trust yourself too, especially in terms of safety, right?
Yeah. And I don't know what the too long is, but don't go too long.
Don't go too long. Exactly. Okay. Well, thanks, Chris, for this delightful conversation.
Thank you for inviting me. I enjoyed this very much.
And thank you for listening to this episode of Being Human. We'll be hosting guests on a regular basis, so be sure to tune in for some more insights on how we can understand ourselves better and live a life on our own terms and one that's meaningful to us. My name is Dr. Chua Suk Ning, and I look forward to sharing some more valuable insights from the world of mental health with you very soon.
Thank you for listening to the Being Human podcast. To find out more about Relate Malaysia's online therapy services, visit us at www.relate.com.my or email us at inquires@relate.com.my. You can also find us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, remember, we are all more human than we are otherwise. Be kind to yourself and take care.